Okay. Oh, my, be ready. Okay, thank you. Good evening and welcome to the October 1st, 2019 regular meeting of the San Luis Coastal Unified School District. We're happy to see you, especially you guys down here. I will first ask if there's any public comment before the beginning of the meeting. Next, is that for a specific?
Or just public comment.
Okay, well, you can make that now or make it a little later in the, you would like to do it, you have, okay, yes, please come forward and state your name. Mr.
Yes.
Underger, you.
And so, I think Staley yeah. Pearl.
And you'll have 3 minutes, and Ms. Dawson will set the timer. Timer. Hi.
This is Ivy and Jack Pearl. We are here representing the We Are the Care initiative, and that was born out of the Where's the Care town hall that was hosted in May 2019. The town hall had a capacity crowd of people who all recognize that there's not enough quality child care in our community to meet the need, and there's not enough early childhood professionals. And families are struggling to be successful in their jobs because of these challenges. And now a group of early childhood professionals, people from the community, families, and government officials like yourselves have partnered to address the local child care crisis. And I'm here asking for your continued support. So thank you for the work you're already doing. October is National Work and Family Month, which seems like a great time to kick off this discussion, and we know that from survey data, it took more than a year on average for most respondents to find care for their children in Slo County. When care is found, it is often unaffordable or the schedule of availability does not meet the family needs. all of this places a huge burden on families who are working to support their family in an area with a high cost of living. And this dilemma is creating barriers for recruiting and retaining employees for local businesses. Senior planner at Slo County, or Slo, Ivy, go on my leg, please, reported that the cost of childcare is so high that it equals a salary. And two working parents have to weigh whether it's worth giving up a second income to have a second child. And with a declining 0 and 5 population, this can have a long-term impact. The goal with the We the Care initiative is to raise public awareness of this real issue and work towards solutions. Our hope is that we can pull our creative ideas together and align our resources to make Slo County the most family-friendly county in California. We will be here next month. Maybe not we, the collective we, but someone from the We Are the Care initiative will be here next month with more to share. If you want to know more about our efforts, contact First Five, but I already read the MOU that y'all are working with First Five, so very grateful for your support, and I hope that it continues. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for coming.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, the board met in closed session, and with regard to a student stipulated student discipline agreement, and we will now, I would like to entertain a motion with regard to that issue and vote here in open session. Mr. Millar.
I'll move the recommendation.
I'll second the recommendation.
We have a motion by Mr. Millar, a second by Mr. Unger. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Carries 5-0. Is there consensus on the order of business? Thank you. So next we have approval of the minutes from September 12. Are there any revisions, changes, comments, approval? Anyone?
So moved.
All right. Thank you. Motion by Mr. Unger, second by Mr. Buckman. All in favor?
Aye.
All right. Right. And then same for the approval of the minutes from September 17th. Any comments? All right, motion by Ms. Prain, second by Mr. Millar, all in favor?
Aye.
All right. Riley, you are our student representative to the board tonight. Thanks for coming.
Hi, I'm Jenna, and I'm the vice president at Morro Bay High. Riley's our president,
I just called you by the wrong name.
Oh, it's okay. Riley has a volleyball game tonight, so she couldn't make it. But this week, we are doing Red Ribbon Week, which is our drug and alcohol prevention week. So Thursday at lunch, we'll have our table in the quad. Actually, it's in the gym this year. And people can sign a pledge to stay drug and alcohol free through high school and college. And then the month of October is our Breast Cancer Awareness Month. So on Wednesdays, we wear pink in support of people who have had and do have breast cancer. And this week is our annual dodgeball tournament. It's our most popular lunchtime tournament, and I will be playing tomorrow, so hopefully I do good. I'm not the most dodgeball-type person, but, you know, got to participate. Last week we had our Powder Puff game. We had over 40 student participants. The seniors lost. But we played really good, and we had a good time, and then the sophomores won and the juniors won. That's about it for now. We're planning our homecoming, which is October 18th. And, yeah, that's about it.
What's your homecoming theme?
A fairy tale.
Great.
Yeah, great. It'll be good.
Well, thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me.
We really appreciate it. Yeah, we understand you may need to get home and do schoolwork down there in Los Osos. And if that's the case, feel free to take care of that. Thank you. Right. And then next we have Bishop's Peak program highlights. Mr.
Yes.
Mayfield.
Good evening. Mr. Block is here with some students and teachers from Bishop's Peak, and he will introduce them, and we'll hear the highlights at Bishop's Peak. Mr. Block.
All right. Good evening. Dan Block, Bishop's Peak Elementary School. First of all, thanks to our students and our parents for getting them here tonight. And, of course, we have Mrs. Salacci, Ms. Kelly, and Mr. Hill. We want to thank them for helping to coordinate tonight as well. The students, we have Sophie Bastidos. Wave so they know who you are here.
Sophie.
Sophia Bates. Richard Schaefer. There we are. Richard Schaefer right there. Natalie Peters. Bob Myers. Ella Bates. Imka Lawrence. And Evie Greenwood. So these are our students presenting to you tonight. We're doing it around the theme of culture of care. At Bishop's Peak, these students, I was talking with them today, getting ready for tonight. Some of them were here. They were at my school since kindergarten, Bishop's Peak students. Others came first grade, second grade. Bob at the end here came in fourth grade. But all of them, through their time here at Bishop's Peak, just kind of have developed into leaders, and it's something we do intentionally at Bishop's Peak. And the programs they're going to describe kind of help build that leadership, and something when I come around to the classrooms, I meet with our sixth graders at the beginning of the year, and we put this on them, that you're the leaders of the school. How you act, the others are going to follow. And here's some of the things that Bishop's Peak does. And first, I am announcing Sophia and Sophie.
Hi. Hi, I'm Sophie, and I'm in sixth grade at Bishop's Peak.
Hi, I'm Sophia. I'm also in sixth grade at Bishop's Peak.
Game day. And it's a presentation.
Every year at the end of the school year, Bishop's Peak sixth graders get a chance to show leadership during games day. Sixth graders make games for younger kids to play.
It usually involves water. It's a long-standing tradition that started out with the school paying people to come and set up games. Then we started letting the sixth graders create their own games.
The work that goes into it. Setting up games day takes a lot of teamwork, and at Bishop's Peak Elementary School, teamwork is a very important skill to develop. We sixth graders learn to work together as well as make new friends while making the games.
Games day helps kids use the creative, innovative parts of their minds.
During games day, sixth graders also learn to be role models to the younger students because we lead the games. We also explain the games to the little kids, which improves and develops our social skills and social intelligence. I mean, we have to get the kids to actually listen.
Giving back. After years of participating in the fun activities of Games Day, It's finally our turn as the new generation of sixth graders to lead Games Day and give back to the Bishop's Peak community.
We're looking forward to being role models and leaders to the younger kids in this year's Games Day.
Thank you for listening. Now we will turn it over to Natalie, who will be talking about integrating students.
Hi, my name is Natalie. I am a fifth grader in Mrs. Solace's class. Tonight I'm here to tell you about how we help the students who come in and out of our classroom. One example is we help the mainstream students from other classrooms on campus. One way is giving them their own desks and supplies. We also assist them with research projects and giving speeches. We try and create a safe class so they can learn as well as we do. This program is very valuable to me and other students on this campus. Thank you for your time. Next is Evie and Ella talking about buddies.
Hi, I'm Ella.
And I'm Evie.
And we're going to talk about buddies. As a sixth grader at Bishop's Peak, I have many opportunities to be a good role model to the younger students. An example of this is being a buddy to the younger grades.
On every Friday, we go and hang out with our first grade buddies. Most of the time, they read to us and we read to them. But sometimes we do special activities such as making applesauce.
Being a buddy means you form a special bond with your little buddy. You share special experiences. For example, on Friday, our buddies gave us this really cute card. Two big buddies from little buddies. Dear big buddies, we've been learning about apples. We will be making applesauce on Friday. Can you come? Love little buddies.
This shows just how much our buddies look up to us. That is why Bishop's Peak thinks it's so important for the upper grades to have connections with lower grades through buddies.
Now we'll turn it over to Richard, who will be talking about mentoring.
I get to use the big kid mic.
Hi, folks. I am very, very proud to be here representing one of the leaders in my classroom, Richard Schaefer. He has prepared a little speech that I'm going to read on his behalf. As a sixth grader of Bishop's Peak, it is my job to be a good role model to younger students of Bishop's Peak. One example of how I do this is I am a mentor for one of our fourth graders for writing and behavior skills. 5 days a week, 15 minutes a day. Sometimes we talk about his day, or we talk and work on his writing for his class. Being a mentor and helping this student grow is something I look forward to. This shows that the kids of Bishop's Peak love to show leadership and being good role models. Thank you for your time. Now Bob and Imka will talk about student council.
My name is Bob Myers, and I'm in the sixth grade.
My name is Imka Lawrence, and I'm in the fifth grade.
And we are talking about Bobcat leadership.
What is Bobcat leadership? Two people from each class are elected to represent the class in Bobcat leadership. We organize things like Spirit Day, Cardboard Challenge, the Food Drive, and more. We also organize poster making to let people know about events.
We hold monthly meetings, and in each one, a different class leads the meeting to talk about a certain subject. For example, Bob's class will present on playground games, and my class will present on historical achievements.
But in order to be in the Bobcat leadership, we must each write a paragraph on why we should be represented, and here are our speeches.
I am Imka Lawrence, and I'm running to be your Bobcat leadership representative. You may know me as the smallest girl in your class, but what you may not know is that I've been a leader in many parts of my life. I'm the oldest of three siblings. This means I lead by example, have to find ways to engage kids of different age groups in different interests and fun and exciting games and activities, and demonstrate trust to my family by being responsible for my actions and true to my word. I'm a dancer. This means I'm able to work with others, I'm dedicated to what I do, but I also know it's time to have some fun. Last but definitely not least, I love my school. Since coming to Bishop's Peak in second grade, I've enjoyed all things leadership has done for us, such as pajama day service projects and fun games. As your Bobcat leadership representative, I will continue these traits and bring new and creative leadership to the school. Vote for Imka. I may be tiny, but I sure am mighty.
And then mine was a lot less, like, oriented. It was just the reason I think I should be represented for Bobcat Leadership is because I'm responsible, creative, and can take a good laugh. I feel that a like student council can feel intimidated if it's super boring and serious and like first order of business, second order of business. Now I feel like if it's super laid back and there's like no work in order, that would also be bad. Nothing would get done. I believe in like in between balance, I guess. I believe I'm responsible because one time the school counselor, Miss Stratton, asked me to take care of a new kid for a few weeks. We ended up being friends until he was transferred. I believe I'm creative and love finding unique ways to do things. I am open to new ideas, and I listen to new ideas, and I think that's important. I know I can't promise things I won't be able to do, so the only thing I'll promise to do is, if you vote for me, try my hardest to represent the class as best as possible. Thank you.
These are Bishop's Peak 5th and 6th graders. Super proud of them. They're available to answer any questions if you have them about what they presented. You guys come over here a little bit, maybe gather around the mic. If you guys have any questions for this group, they'd be happy to answer.
All right. Let's go to the board, Mr. Buckman.
Yep. I have a question. Yeah. So sometimes our board is kind of like we do things. So I just wondered if you could stay and be an advisor and help us. You could start tonight.
What?
You could start tonight.
Sure, if you explain how everything works, because I felt like before this.
All right, well, thank you.
Maybe he'll be up here as a high school representative one day. Or any of these guys here.
Any other questions? I'd also like to point out that the Teacher of the Year for San Luis Coastal Unified School District is a Bishop's Peak teacher, and I believe I see her.
Stand up.
Yeah. Congratulations. You're honored through your children, through your students as well, and through.
Wonderful.
I can tell. Anyone else from the board? Any other comments?
I just wanted to congratulate all of you. I was pretty impressed with kind of your levels of care engagement, you know, very intentional. It was particularly that buddy love scenario that you have, and very curious about how you come up with the games. I would love to be invited to come see the game day and see that creativity. So pretty special, and thank you for caring so much about your school and your buddies and your peers and being great leaders, and thank you.
Thanks a lot for coming.
So the games day is the last day of school. It's like 10 o'clock till noon, somewhere in there, but we can send out an invite. Good. Just a super quick story on games day. Mr. Hill has been in sixth grade for a while, and one day the student comes up to us, and a sixth grade student, and says, "You should do games day earlier in the year." And we look at him and say, how come? And the student says, "Because when we're given directions, no one's listening, and they're all over the place, they're going crazy." And so we weren't making the connection. And so why should we do it? Because we would have been much better listeners all year long if we would have known what we were like as students. So I love that insight from a sixth grader. It was many years ago, but it's one we tell every game day. So anyway, thank you guys very much.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.
Thanks for taking the time. All right, at this time, we kind of did this a little out of order because our previous person making public comment needed to get on her way. But at this time, we would ask if there's anyone here who... I obviously skipped it. I'm going to keep going. If there's anyone here who would like to make public comment for an item not on the agenda. All right. And then... correspondence. We had a letter from Sarah Flickinger regarding the Coastal Bilingual Program, a letter from the San Luis Obispo County Office of Education regarding our LCAP and fiscal year 2019-20 board approved budget. It was all positive. And a letter from Melissa Donay regarding the Coastal Bilingual Program. We will move on to superintendent's updates, business and budget.
Yeah, so just one quick budget item tonight, and that is, you know, right now is kind of the transition time before CBEDS when we're trying to get students and parents to fill out their free and reduced lunch forms. So for several of our school sites, it's really critical in terms of if they have to meet that 40% requirement in order to receive Title I sites, in particular our elementary. So we've been monitoring that over the past, month, basically. And it's what happens is the free and reduced lunch applications are good throughout the month of September. And so it as much as we try to get people to fill them out, it's not until the actual cutoff date that we really get people to start applying and getting those numbers to come up. So it's for one school in particular, Monter Grove, been very scary over the past few years because they've barely made it. Right now, they're a little bit under the 40% mark, but very close. So they've risen from like 35% to I think 39% as of today. So Aaron works again with the principals at the sites to get the word out because we want to make sure that we're feeding kids, right? And so it's just one of those critical things that we work on. I look forward to the day when our cafeterias are done at our two comprehensive high schools and we can try to get those students to sign up and to take lunch and to do that because the numbers really drop. Kids just don't sign up. And so it's definitely a goal of ours with those facilities to really increase participation as we as we move forward.
Yeah, it's good for kids. All right. Mrs. Rath, educational services.
Great. I have some great things to share. A couple of neat things happening on October 2nd. We have Pack Beach Back to School Night. And then also One Drop of Love, which is a one-person play that will be taking place 10:30 and 1:30. And should be a great opportunity for people to think about some racial questions and to kind of contemplate some of those important topics. So happy to have them. I had the real pleasure of riding with the foundation on the prize patrol, so that was a total blast on the school bus, really surprising some school sites and making some kids' days. So that was a lot of fun. Dr. Prater held his first student senate, a great opportunity to hear from many of our secondary students about the culture on their school site and what we can do to work together to keep improving things. We had the pleasure last night of honoring Kim Kelly that you just met here, as well as Nancy Bray, our two employees of the year. And it was a great ceremony put on by the county office and Cuesta hosting it, so they did a great job. We have started our bilingual program planning, so we're looking forward to catching you up kind of on a more formal basis, but we have started those group talks and started to look at applications when people are interested in serving on some of the subcommittees. That information will be coming out soon, so just letting you know we're getting started on that. We're also hearing rumor that there's a new LCAP template coming along, so hopefully they're going to make things more concise, more organized is their goal, to have things, so that it's a little more manageable on the front end, maybe with more kind of appendices on the back end. So we will cross our fingers that is something that is maybe more digestible for the public. Thank you.
Thank you. Measure D, Mr. Pinkerton.
So, a couple exciting things. Number one, we got confirmation that the $3.4 million worth of CT grants for three of our projects and grants at San Luis Obispo High School were actually getting funded. So that's the 300 building. So that, again,
awesome.
Very exciting, right, to know not just that, the grant's been awarded, but that we're actually going to get funded. Yeah. And so there's another cycle going around for more CT grants, so we're going to be putting our we have two that scored pretty well last time. They're going to put back in and actually are trying to kind of drum up and beef up our drama grant for San Luis Obispo High School. But the other two were for Morro Bay High. So we're very hopeful that, again, looking for any way possible for us to increase the amount of funds that we have available for our construction projects through Measure D. So that's something that we'll be working on. And then exciting news today, the 30 concrete trucks rolled into San Luis Obispo High School, and there's actually the bottom of a pool now.
Woo-hoo.
That has been there, right? So a lot of rain, a lot of, kind of hold up for that project, and I had a lot of threats out there, me personally, against our, friends and contractors and fellow coworkers that pool better get done before it rains, and was very excited to see those 30 concrete trucks roll today. So I know, it's okay. I didn't have to follow up through those threats, so it was a good thing.
Yeah.
No, but in all jest, it was just exciting to see the construction going and looking forward to having great facilities for our kids.
Getting So do we know when we'll receive the funding, the funds for the grants?
It's this fiscal year we should receive them. Yeah, so that construction's already started, so...
Yeah, I just know that some of the grants we apply for, but we may not see the money.
Like modernization funds, those types, state modernization, those are things that, yeah, we might receive 7-8 years from now.
Okay.
These are funds that we're actually, like Bellevue Santa Fe, like we've already received those funds for the matching grant. So these CT projects we're currently under construction at the 300 wing. So we should receive those with this fiscal year into next.
Great.
Yeah.
And has the labor pool gotten any better? I know that we were having a little trouble just because of all the work going on.
Yeah, there's a few issues that we've been working through. So we're hopeful that, you know, we're going to catch up at the 300 wing with that project. But the next phase of projects are design build, so they're non-skilled and trained part. So we're hopeful, especially with the 100 building, that we're going to see more bids.
Okay, great. Thank you, Ryan. All right, next we have a public hearing on determination of sufficient textbooks and instructional materials. Mr. Mason.
Yes, good evening. Each year we're required to stipulate that we are sufficient in textbooks in four key areas, mathematics, science, history, social studies, and English language arts. We have verified that we are sufficient this year. Tonight we need to hold a public hearing to get any kind of public input, and then at the next session we will have a resolution to that effect, that we are sufficient in textbooks at this time.
Great, thank you. So I will now open the public hearing with regard to this issue. Is there anyone from the public wishing to address the board regarding our determination of sufficient textbooks and instructional materials? Seeing no one, I will close the public hearing and we will have the resolution at our next meeting. We will move to the discussion action portion of the agenda, and first is item 9.01, Board Priority 1, Academic Achievement for All Engagement Structures.
Good evening, Board. Thank you. Tonight is really something each of you already knows a whole lot about. However, I thought it's a worthwhile way to reconfirm and reaffirm the things that we do in our school district to engage our community, our staff community, our student community, our parent community, and, quite frankly, our broader community. And so I thought it was worthwhile to, thought it would be worthwhile to review some of these structures that I'm referring to as engagement structures. And the reason for these structures, and the more we do these structures, it's becoming more and more clear that when we meet on a regular basis to discuss meaningful and relevant topics around what's best for kids, through these structures we're able to pull rich feedback that actually guides our thinking. And so when you look at the variety of structures that I have here tonight to discuss, I won't go through them all because it would take all day, but I will just touch on some of them. So first and foremost, I put together a list of the primary engagement structures that we use in our district to ensure that our goals and our areas of focus are reflective of the truest needs of our community and our student community. So with that, I have the Common Ground Advisory Task Force. And as a reminder, this particular structure is made up and has grown from what was originally sort of a crisis in our district with the incident that occurred at San Luis Obispo High School about 4 years ago. And we created a Common Ground Advisory Task Force that is made up of religious leaders, community leaders, staff leaders, student leaders, and also a broad mix of community leaders. And what we do is we meet about 7 times a year, and in those meetings, what the focus on this particular group is to figure out ways to identify structures and systems in our district that might improve inclusivity and equity. And so we're digging deep into these things, and it's amazing. The recommendations that were given to me over the last 3 years have truly been rich and wise, but very difficult on some levels to implement across the district. So we are using these recommendations to help inform us as to ways we can improve our school district to become more inclusive and equitable across the district for all kids, especially our more marginalized student populations. The next group that we work with is the Student Senate. And as Ms. McGrath mentioned, we had our first Student Senate meeting last week, and I just have to say it was really wonderful to see some familiar faces from the years past. This is our fourth year doing the Student Senate, and we have over 65 students participating across all our middle and high schools. And our admin leads from the sites are actually participating as well. The core component of the Student Senate is that we actually implement a youth truth survey to all students. Last year, we had 92% participation rate for all middle and high school students in our district. And what areas we looked at were areas of student engagement in the classroom, safety, overall wellness, drugs, alcohol, bullying, all those elements that we know get in the way of students feeling successful and safe. And so we're embarking on another year, and where the students are taking the lead on this. They, just so you know, the students, when they derive their goals based on their peer feedback, then what they do is they engage their teachers at their schools. So imagine middle school students sitting in a room with their teachers and sharing this information in a thoughtful, meaningful way and seeking their input. And what we're finding across middle and high school, what we're finding is that the teachers are rolling up their sleeves and engaging, and they're really doing a fantastic job of meeting the students where they're at with great intentionality. So I'm super excited about where this is going. And those goals at the end of the spring get folded into the annual SPSAs, Single Plans for Student Achievement, as well as our LCAP. So you're seeing actual movement from the Student Senate initiative into our primary guiding goal document, which I think is just phenomenal. And one of the things to note is that when you look at their goals from last year that they wish to push forward, and I'm going to synthesize them, but at the middle school, what your middle and high school, each of them, every single one of those schools, our schools, the students are saying they want to be engaged. They, as their top priority, feel that they want to be engaged with rigorous and relevant activities and learning in the classrooms. Now imagine sharing that with your class, with your teachers at your school. So it's a tough conversation, but it's a worthwhile one because there's a lot of layers to it. And then in addition to that, the other element that we see running through the Student Senate goals across middle and high school are efforts to be inclusive and more equitable, to ensure that all kids feel connected and feel like they belong. And so that's a real important effort by this group. And I'm really proud to be a part of that. And I want you to know that my entire cabinet team participates in this as well. So we also were fortunate to have Mrs. Frame and Dr. Eisendreth Rogers come and observe last week. And that's always good as well. So I would like to extend that welcome to all of you if you'd ever like to come. We meet every other month during the course of the year. And I'll share that information with you. And we also have new, this is our second year, it's the district equity team, which Mr. Mayfield has engineered and runs. And this district equity team really is working on a parallel course with our Common Ground and our Student Senate. And they're doing some really important work around the areas of professional development for our staff and our employees to make sure that they're getting the right kinds of training. So next week we have gender spectrum training coming to our site, as well as I know there are equity walks coming up as well. Super excited about that. And you've heard the LCAP outreach plan, and we're doing our best to engage our staff, parent, and parent community to ensure that we're getting the best kinds of feedback to inform our LCAP, and we share that with you as we move along in the year. And then the last group that I'd like to share is the parent leadership, the parent leaders group. And this particular group is made up of PTA and booster leaders across parent leaders across our district. We typically have anywhere from 20 to 40 parents participate each month. And in this framework, we also, what we're doing is we're folding in presentations from my cabinet team and from the and also from site leadership teams that come and share with parents the very things that we're hearing in the Student Senate, in the Common Ground, in the district equity team, so that the parent leaders are informed as we move along, so that when we ask them for feedback on our LCAP, they have a context to work within. So we're finding that to be super meaningful. So I would like to say that this is this may seem like a whole lot of effort and work, because it is. But it's worthwhile, and it's important work. Every year we get better and better at it. I envision a time in the next 5 years that this becomes a refined process where those goals across each of those frames, engagement structures, begin to align, and that our goals as a district become super focused. And I'm excited to see us going in that direction to benefit all kids. So that's my presentation to you tonight.
Thank you. Any questions from the board? Comments? Mr. Buckman?
I have my choice of four of these microphones. My first comment is it is important work, as you said, and I think you may be shortchanging the staff and the amount of time and effort that you're putting in, because as I look at this, I saw some other groups that I was going to suggest that you might want to add, the ELACs,
of course,
the DLAC, and the Title I group, and the amount of time that staff puts towards this effort is just remarkable. I also want to add that Marilyn and I sit on the equity team, and I don't want to speak for Marilyn, but I know that the work, from my perspective, has just been amazing. And when the vote came at the end of the year, Mr. Mayfield and said, "Do we want to go forward?" And I think everybody on that team just was like, "Yeah, we want to keep going." So I want to applaud the staff for working this hard.
Thank you. Thank you. Anyone else? All right. Then our next item is 9.02, Advanced Agenda Topic, IT Filters and Protocols.
During the September 17th board meeting, at Del Mar, the board expressed interest in an advanced agenda topic to understand the district's protocols and practices regarding internet filters and protections related to inappropriate material. And it was brought to my attention that you'd like to place this on an advanced agenda. And pursuant to our protocol, I am bringing it back to you for that discussion as to how would you like to proceed. Would you like this to go on the October 15th agenda, which we can do? We already met with Jeremy Kellish, our IT director, who's prepared to come and speak to this. That's one option. The other option is a Friday update to the board, and I'm sure some of you might have some other ideas. So I give it back to you.
Mr. Unger?
So I brought this up, and I'm the one that had the interest in this, and I think I do want to know more about this. I think it's really important for we as the board and the public as well to understand the care and the effort that we put into having a secure system for our students and for our faculty. I know we're doing a lot, but I think it's important for us to hear that, especially because there are federal requirements, I believe, that we engage in those kinds of behavior activities. The other thing I'm interested in a little bit broader topic with this, and I hope it's within the context of this item, I think there's quite a bit that about cybersecurity these days. For example, ransomware, things like that. Municipalities, school districts are having their basically their servers hijacked for ransom. And I'd be interested in knowing what we're doing to protect ourselves against things like that. I was going to suggest that it might be nice for Jeremy to come here, but I would like to propose to the board that in one of our Thursday equity walks, we go to the information technology, and we actually meet with the people there and see the department and see what kinds of things they're doing. And I was wondering if other people would have an interest in that.
So first of all, let me get more input, if that's all right with you, just
absolutely,
on this topic, because then we'll need to see if there's a second to support what we're doing. Mr. Buckman.
So I don't know if Chris was making a motion. Do you need a motion and a second?
I will, but
okay.
Let's see where we stand.
So I, too, am very interested. But I just want to caution us on the equity walks. My understanding is we all as a board cannot go on the equity walks at any one time because we'd have to have a public notice on it, which I don't have a problem having a public notice. I just want to remind everybody that it would actually become an open meeting and all this stuff.
Yeah, you're exactly right. We would notice it to the public, and if the members of the public would like to come and learn, they could.
Yeah, I don't know how I feel about having members of the public going through our IT department because we were, you're talking about security and exposure and things. So,
well, we do have two equity walks on the same day, a morning and an afternoon, and it's conceivable that we could avoid the public posting by having a sign up for the morning session and the afternoon session. That's possible too.
So if I can, I just heard, and it didn't dawn on me, but I think it's really important if we're going to be discussing this, it will be the security and safety of the students. And I'm wondering if this falls under closed session at some point. I know in the site plans, they have plans that are in there, but those don't get released to the public because of school safety. So I'm wondering if this qualifies for closed session at some point.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I can certainly look at that. In this sort of field trip concept, I think, you know, I've been back in there as well. It would just be there's a conference room there. There could be a presentation as to how, like, what we do. It's pretty complex, and I don't think there's anything secretive about it. It's just a series of advanced server protocols that we use that I've heard about. They're it's pretty amazing, actually. It'd be great, I would imagine, for you guys to see it. I don't know if it falls under closed session for those reasons, but I could look.
So it sounds a little mushy to me. So if you want to Mr. Millar.
Sure.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
Well, I can't see you. Yeah, okay. I'm sorry, Mr. Millar.
Well, I think since this initially aired by way of a public complaint about it, I think it's important to be handled in a public meeting. I also have been to IT. I was pretty impressed. I'm not sure what being in the space will really lend to presentations and understanding what it is you guys do. But I do think it would be important to be in an accessible public environment for both parent and family kind of information and reassurance.
So, Mr. Unger.
So I'd like to move that we do a presentation on internet. Actually the topic that we originally discussed, the internet filters and protocols, in an open session, and ask Jeremy to come and present to us and the public the kinds of things that we're doing to protect ourselves and protect our children.
So at a regularly scheduled meeting.
At a regularly scheduled meeting, yes.
I'll second that.
All right, we have a motion by Mr. Unger, a second by Mr. Buckman. All in favor?
Aye. I'll work with my staff and then in PLRC to land on a date.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
Okay. 9.03 A through G profile update. Mr. Mayfield.
Yes, hello again. Tonight we're going to take a look at our high school graduating seniors from last year in terms of meeting the A to G requirements. As you know, A to G is a state of California requirement for admission into the California State University or the University of California. And on the first slide, let's turn it on. That's the first question IT always asks you. Did you turn it on? Okay. On the first slide, as you can see, these are the number of years required in each particular subject area. The graphic on the right-hand side shows that for students need 2 years of history, 4 years of English, et cetera, as it goes on down the page. What we do to determine the data that we're going to share with you tonight is we send out a spreadsheet at the beginning of the year, or actually at the very end of the year, of all the graduating seniors, and it lists on there, you know, all the courses they took and all the information as to why they are or are not A to G eligible. And then sites go through that data with their counselors and the administrators to determine if there's any anomalies or any mistakes that we have made in the data. And then we have in-depth conversations to review the data and what it shows us. So we'll first take a look at Morro Bay High School. And as you can see, over a three-year period of time, the numbers were up last year, but have been relatively stable at about 54 and now 53% over a three-year period of time. I think when you look at the other data, it almost seems like a little bit of a spike, but there are some concerning areas that we've discussed at Morro Bay High School. The next slide shows all the different subgroups that we always break out with our data. On the top is the all students. Next would be the non-socioeconomically disadvantaged students, followed by the socioeconomically disadvantaged students, et cetera. The numbers on the left-hand side indicate the total number in that category, and then the percentage on the bar is the percentage of that total number. On the following slide, we look at a three-year comparison of all of our groups. The all group on top, again, non-socioeconomically disadvantaged, socioeconomically disadvantaged English learner, redesignated functional English proficient, and then at the bottom, students with disabilities. And as you can see, there's a couple of groups that we're especially concerned about, students with disabilities and socioeconomically disadvantaged for production over the last 3 years. And it's a complicated scene out there in terms of A to G, and especially all the changes that have happened over the course of the year. But we've had in-depth conversations with Morro Bay High School as to these trends and what they plan to do about them. We'll take a look at San Luis Obispo High School. As you can see, looking at the overall data over the last 3 years, numbers are pretty stable, 69% this year, same as last year. Breaking it down by subgroup, 337 students in the all group, 69% of those students were A to G compliant. In the non-SED, almost 80%. The socioeconomically disadvantaged group, just about 38%. The English learner group, 9%. And then the redesignated functional English proficient, 47%. And students with disabilities at only 2%. You'll see three-year patterns for all subgroups there. The all group has been relatively stable. I would say the same about the non-socioeconomically disadvantaged group. Like Morro Bay High School, you know, a three-year decline in socioeconomically disadvantaged, which you know, is something for us to discuss, and we have discussed that and what we would do about that. And then RFEP has been relatively stable, and as you can see, students with disabilities has gone down significantly. And then in summary, I would say at Morro Bay High School, the numbers are down slightly over a three-year period, looking at three-year trends. The RFEP group especially showed growth over 3 years, and the site focus is on socioeconomically disadvantaged and being A to G compliant. At San Luis Obispo High School, the numbers are relatively steady over a three-year period. The RFEP numbers also steady over that three-year period, and the site focus is also on the socioeconomically disadvantaged group. Some of the big ahas for me were that the biggest obstacle to A to G are Ds in a subject. So one D in a particular subject can keep a student from being A to G compliant. If a D is late in a student's career, sometimes even their senior year, they may decide that they're not going to go on to Cal State University or University of California, so they won't make up the D, and then that will keep them from compliance. Another reason would be if they were going out of state. So the A to G requirements don't apply to universities out of state and don't apply to, of course, going to junior college as well. And then we had discussions about being more prescriptive with students in their junior and senior year and making sure they understand the importance of being A to G compliant. And, of course, our goal would be to have all students A to G compliant and have completed at least one CTE pathway before graduation. Okay.
Thank you. Mr. Buckman?
Thanks. So I have two questions.
Sure.
One, I didn't notice this before tonight, but the link between this item and the first item under this 9.01 and the culture of care and the gap between SED and non-SED.
Mm-hmm.
And in my opinion, the work that the Equity Group and other groups such as Dr. Prater and you, Kim, put together and are working on will be an impetus to close this gap. The second question I have is, I can't remember, did we take advantage of the state law that said we could have a CTE graduation requirement and it would basically take the place or run concurrent with the visual arts? I think we did, but I can't remember.
I can help you with that. So, we do have an option for in a graduation requirement. A CTE course would count for that, but do keep in mind that graduation requirements are different than A to G requirements.
Right. Okay. So, and I appreciate that, but it's my understanding, and maybe we need to look at this, it's my understanding that specifically was to allow it to be one of the A to G's.
So, well, all of our CTE courses are A to G approved.
Okay. So maybe I'm misunderstanding. When you say there was a difference between the graduation rate, the graduation and the A to G, my understanding is that the CTE classes will allow the student to comply with the A through G and take the place of visual and performing arts.
So, Rick, do you mind putting the first slide?
We're probably saying the same thing. I have wax in my ear.
Yeah, so on the first slide, notice how in A to G requirements, you have, it's actually visual and performing arts, and then you have college prep as G, so that's the F requirement and the G requirement. So all of our CTE courses fit mostly in the G, a little bit in F, and somewhat in science, but it is different than graduation requirements. For example, have physical education as a requirement, have, you know, different requirements. They don't completely align. So in order for a student to graduate from high school, they can take a CTE course, and that can count as a fine art. But fine art is not an A to G requirement. So also our CTE courses are all approved in one of these categories.
Okay. I'm misunderstanding this chart because it looks like, I don't want to beat this, it looks like F is part of the A through G.
Yeah, F is visual and performing.
And we're putting such an emphasis in the district and doing such a great job on CTE. I guess what I'm asking is, if we are not, and we have not, the district has not adopted the policy, it's my understanding that there's a policy that would allow our CTE students to qualify for A through G using their CTE, I think it has to be 1 year or some completion. So,
we can certainly look.
I'd be happy to discuss it with you after.
Because
courses in CTE are currently have one of the A through G requirements.
So if we're in agreement later, it struck me that we've got the visual and performing arts here, and since we have such an effort on CTE,
right.
I would like to see the CTE here recognized. But that's, we'll do it later.
Sure.
Thanks.
Okay. Ms. Frame, then Ms. Stronger.
Hi, Mr. Mayfield. As I'm looking at the data, is each year a senior cohort?
Correct.
Okay. And then when I was looking at Morro Bay and Slo High, what struck out with me is, or stood out for me, is that it's not pretty, but Morro Bay is there. Even though the numbers are small, their subgroup percentages are kind of in a better area. And I don't know if that's that particular cohort, but they're doing right. Seem to be focusing and doing a little bit better job. And other thing is, when we were looking at, and I don't know if this relates for our, looking at Slo High and Morro Bay High, we have a group of students that are at our elementary sites, but then they will go to necessarily like a school of choice, mm-hmm. Perhaps in town, and then they stay and go through matriculate. Does that influence that cohort?
It certainly
data
could.
At Slo High?
It certainly could, sure.
So not to, okay. And the biggest concern, stuck out at me is the gap between those groups seems greater than the standardized testing. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Is that, am I?
No, I think that's correct. Yep.
And so,
that's an accurate observation.
Yet, we're making efforts in that area. So it's kind of, it just struck me as odd because mm-hmm. we're, really trying to focus and make it. And yet, for whatever reason, whether it's newness or that, those subgroups, I don't know. Mm-hmm.
It's an ongoing effort to just talk to kids. And we're doing it earlier and earlier into the junior high schools about, getting college ready and college and career ready. When they graduate, and giving themselves options, even if they may not think that they're going to go to a Cal State University or University of California, finish the requirements for A to G. And so that was something that came up in our discussions this year, was we may need to get a little more prescriptive with students at the, at that level, a junior, senior level, and say, hey, this is a course. You can retake this course, and it will set you up to be A to G compliant and paying attention to that.
Well, I'm even wondering if, or particularly for some of our really at-risk subgroups, is even before middle school, what are that targeted at elementary sites for those conversations with students or parents? Because it's just something to throw out. So, thank you.
I'd say in my experience at elementary, it's been more general. The you're going to go to college conversation as opposed to here's the specific steps you need to, to finish college and be career and college ready.
Thank you.
Mr. Unger.
So I have a couple of questions for you, Rick. So if the students aren't taking A to G classes, what's our sense of what kinds of classes they are taking in order to graduate, understanding that our graduation requirements, and graduation requirements are, I think, a little bit different at each school, right? Number of credits, anyway. What are they taking to graduate? Because they're obviously graduating. Our graduation rates are, 97%, 98%, something like that?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd be happy to address that. So there's two ways that you're not A to G. One is if you choose not to complete one of those totals there. So let's say that I decide not to take, finish out my world language, right? I know that I'm going to go to Cuesta. 2 years of free community college, right, is a huge, amazing thing that Cuesta offers for our students. So if I've decided and my family's decided that's the best place for me, sometimes it's super hard to talk a kid into, hey, let's go ahead and finish that third year science. Let's finish that, second year of world language, etc. So that's one, is by the course selection. Okay, so maybe they are really into other things within, that maybe they are piling up lots of F, lots of G's, lots of, right, taking more science classes, but they decided not to take that second world language class. That would do it. Now you would not be A to G. The other thing, course selection, and the other thing is, as Rick said, D's and F's, right? So when it comes to an F, as he explained, there's often a structure to have a student retake a course when they receive an F in the course, because often you need it for graduation. But if you have a D, we don't always insist that a kid then retake that whole course. So to Rick's point, sometimes one D in one course somewhere along their way now makes them not A to G eligible. And for a lot of students and families, they say, and we're headed to Cuesta, or we're going to the military, or we're going to out of state, and it's not really relevant. So it kind of, you have to think kind of the two directions.
So another question kind of along that line is, are our CTEs, really our strong CTE pathway students, completing their A to G requirements? And I guess I'm thinking about my son, for example, who this was prior to the CTE pathways. He was a musician. He took a bunch of music classes. He did not complete the A to G requirements, but he got into a conservatory of music. So are we seeing our kids that are in strong CTE programs completing their A to G requirements, understanding that maybe they don't want to go to, or they do want to go to Cuesta, for example, as you're talking about, because it's they have some phenomenal programs there.
I love that question, because the conversation has changed from when I think I was in school and likely when you were in school, of it used to be kind of college or career, right? Yeah. And so the key word changing or to and, so that our objective would be, go ahead, Chris, say it.
I was going to say, actually, when I was growing up, it was college or the draft. But
So the key word is or, changing to and. So for us, we want to, first of all, keep doors open for students. Second of all, ensure that we're challenging kids to rigorous curriculum. So if we can say, let's work all that we can to have a kid college and career ready. If you see the two posters outside my office, those are two examples. If you're at the high schools, you'll see those posters of kids that they're honoring and that they're putting up on the high school walls to say, hey, this kiddo was college and career ready. They finished a pathway. They found an interest while they were in high school, and they went through the sequence of courses, and they're able to be A to G prepared also. That opens lots of doors. The beautiful part to me, and sorry, this is a little bit soapbox for me, but I'm passionate about this, is what I love about it is when they're college and career ready is that, one, it has showed that they have attended rigorous courses, right? A to G approved courses. And when they've completed a CTE pathway, it's likely they've started to develop their skills and find some interest and passions so that they can leave us and further pursue those interests. That's why the key word and is one thing that we're working towards.
And then the other question I have is, so how does this all tie into the discussion that we've had? I don't remember if it was last week or last meeting or meeting before. Kind of tie into our AP and dual enrollment discussions. You know, if so, for example, I'm curious, does a student who is dually enrolled at Cuesta meet A to G requirements, even though they're getting college credit? So how does that all kind of work together? Because to me, I think the dual enrollment is key, especially for a lot of our students or students that don't have the financial resources, things like that. I really think that this becomes super important. So can you talk to me a little bit about that?
Yes. Sorry, Rick.
That's quite all right.
I do love the
topic.
You're
doing great.
Love the topic. So the dual enrolled courses would be you're getting college credit while you're getting high school credit, right? And the great part is it would fulfill one piece of that. Now, can I say that because they take a dual enrolled class, they have their A to G requirements completed? Not necessarily. That is one of them. It checks one of the boxes. But it could be that a student took a dual enrollment course and didn't necessarily finish their other A to G requirements, or had a D in a separate course, right? The beautiful thing is we look at all of the things that a dual enrolled course does for a student, opens their eyes to, hey, look at this, I can complete a college course. I can have this under my belt. It opens their eyes to, look what I can do. And hear this mysterious thing that sometimes sits out there thinking, not sure if I can tackle this or not. And in a high school experience, they're able to complete that. The beautiful thing is, when they're finished with that course, that grade is on a transcript. There's no, let's see if you pass the AP course, let's see if you pass the AP test, let's see if the college that you go to accepts that AP test, let's see what credit that university is going to choose to give you or not. They automatic have a transcript with the grade on it.
And I can tell you that with both high schools, we had excellent in-depth conversations about specifics and about patterns and students and, you know, what can we do to get to those subgroups to make sure that those students are aware and that we can, we're providing everything that we can provide so they can finish school A to G compliant.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Anyone from the public here to discuss this? Thank you. All right. Next is 9.04, the Education Foundation. Thank you, Christine Roberts. Hudson? I always want to call you Roberts.
Good evening, Board. I get to start out with a fun update about our recent innovation grants. So I want to take you through specific awards that we made. So you will recall that the innovation grants were the first activity of the foundation to engage with our local schools and begin providing resources to support teachers and school sites. These grants were a little bit unique from the type of grant making that some of our teachers have been familiar with to date. These innovation grants were really designed to inspire educators and staff to be thinking big, to bring forward ideas that could have transformational impacts on learning. And then our board also emphasized in these that we're looking for ideas with measurable impact and scale. And what we mean by scale is if this idea works at one school site, we want to see that it can be replicated at other schools. Because one of the things that is so important to the foundation is that we have that district-wide perspective. We see, for example, the PTAs as being frontline advocates for school sites, and the foundation as playing a different but very complementary role of having that district perspective and thinking about equity across school campuses. And so this idea of replication and scale is at the heart of what we're doing in our grant-making strategy. So the deadline for the innovation grants was back August 25th. We received 22 proposals. And it wasn't just 22 proposals, it was 22 amazing proposals. We were really excited that these 22 proposals came from 13 school sites. So we had broad response and participation to this invitation. There were 10 coastal schools, 12 SLO or city schools, 9 elementary, 5 middle schools, and 9 high schools. Out of those 22 incredible proposals, and I will share with you that we had members of our board served on the grant review committee. They put in a tremendous amount of time and effort trying to evaluate and score. And those foundation board members would report that out of this process, they developed a new appreciation for what teachers do because they said, boy, it is really hard to try to grade or evaluate something and to do that fairly across all of these quality submissions. But we funded 7 proposals out of those 22. So the first one that I want to share with you was an award made to Hawthorne Elementary. The title of their proposal was Seeing Our World, Sharing Our Community with the World. We are excited to provide $10,000 to Hawthorne, and what this $10,000 will support is a set of 30 virtual reality or augmented reality devices, as well as a 3D 360 camera. And so in the proposal that was submitted by the school principal, they said, we want to open the world to our students. We want to allow them to see different cultures, different places, and to do that from the school site through a combination of before, during, and after school programs that the school site is developing. And so not only under this program will the students have the ability with these virtual reality technologies to experience these other places and cultures, but also this 3D 360 camera. What the principal is envisioning is having the students go out
and capture content and produce virtual reality content about our community that could share with kids across the world what's special about this place and our community, our experience here. Next. The next award was to Monarch Grove for their Leader in Me program. Some of you may be familiar with this book, Leader in Me, and it's a program that exists in other schools. I think the closest schools to our region that are Leader in Me schools, there's one in Ventura and a very small school up in San Miguel. This is a really exciting program that, by its name, you can tell fosters leadership. But where this fit into the foundation's priorities is this is a whole child strategy. This is really looking at building a campus culture where all staff, all educators, parents, and students are practicing the 7 habits of highly effective people. We're familiar with Stephen Covey's book, and exhibiting and having the opportunity to demonstrate leadership day in and day out. So this infuses everything about the instructional strategy for elementary students. All right, the next is a $10,000 award to San Luis High, and this was for their Slow High Makerspace. This matched with the foundation's college and career readiness goals, and what this is doing is creating both a physical space and what the sort of proponent of this proposal, Zach Roper, who's a CTE teacher, what he calls an experiential incubator. So this is allowing students from different CTE classes that are involved in the creation and production of something, whether it's multimedia content, ceramics, something in wood shop or metal fabrication, but they are creating something, to have a place where they can come and showcase their creations and then learn how to build a small business around whatever that passion may be and bring those items or experiences to market. So we love the entrepreneurship and the CTE component of this proposal. Next is Makerspace in a Box, and this is Los Ranchos Elementary, and we provided that teacher, Sylvia Gomes, with a $5,000 award. And what Sylvia recognized, and our board was just thrilled that she recognized, that there right now are different levels of access to technology and these innovation spaces across our elementary school sites. And that sort of fragmented access means that kids going through our schools have varied levels of exposure or experience with project-based learning or hands-on technology opportunities. And so she said, you know, as we see school sites working to create innovation labs, let's take a step back and start collaborating and get these teachers talking to one another and see if we can begin building a blueprint for what should be in one of our innovation labs, and then how do we connect these tools and resources to instruction. And so she's really championing this effort to start a district-wide conversation around innovation spaces. Next is out at Morro Bay High School, we provided a $5,570 award to Brady Halverson, who runs the physics and engineering program out there. And this electronics and Arduino foundation, this is one I may not be the most sort of proficient to describe. Brady did a better job when we were providing the award of describing to his own students what he was up to. But essentially, Brady mapped out in his proposal a really exciting vision for a world-class engineering pathway that he wants to create out at Morro Bay High School. And he has, I think, 5 verticals within that pathway. One that is currently underdeveloped, because it's all new and he's working to create this from scratch, is the circuits and electronics vertical. And so this specific grant will provide him with some of the tools and equipment that will enable this new focus on circuits and electronics. And one of the things that excited our board about this proposal was Brady described how the projects enabled by these technologies can open engineering and manufacturing to engage more girls by providing connections to experiences that would be more relevant to a more diverse student population. Next is the Pacheco Media Lab, and this is a $5,000 award that aligns with the foundation's priorities of innovation and equity. This proposal submitted by the school's principal is to help them build the Pacheco Media Lab. And the vision here is to provide equity for socioeconomically disadvantaged students to develop 21st century skills around communication so that they can be harnessing multimedia to communicate, explain, and influence through different mediums. So there are cameras, green screens, video equipment, sound equipment that will help them produce videos, pictures, newsletters, and the school wants to empower those students to begin communicating updates about school activities and sharing information out to the school community and the parent community. And then the last grant, our seventh, was to Teach Elementary for a program that they call the Social Emotional Learning with Kinful. And Kinful is a particular technology platform that's virtual reality as well. And what this does is it has students sharing peer-to-peer content, both consuming content and sharing content around social emotional themes and really working to build community locally and globally. And so this allows them to produce content that shares their own perspective and helps them articulate sort of what that perspective is. So we're excited to see how this unfolds as well. All right, and then next up. So following the award of those seven innovation grants, we are currently, right now, in the midst of what we call our People's Choice Award. So we shared out those seven amazing projects with the broader community, and we've now invited the public to see the good work that's happening in this district and tell us which of those seven ideas they, the public, think will have the biggest impact on learning, and then we will award that project an additional $5,000 in support. We are going to have this People's Choice voting open until next week. We have already received about 5,000 votes. It's been pretty amazing to see the passion at the school sites and the PTAs and some chambers of commerce and other folks in the community really getting invested in helping resource these incredible ideas at their schools. But also, we've seen neighboring schools jumping in and being cheerleaders for their local neighborhood school and just some amazing community that's coming out of this. So we're really excited for the People's Choice Award to be decided in the next week or so. And then on the heels of that, our foundation will be opening our second cycle of grant making, which are student grants. These are geared for high school, and the call will go out to our high school students for them to share with us their ideas for how to make their campus an even better place to be and to learn. And these awards will be about $1,000 to support a student-initiated project or idea. And following that, later, at the end of this calendar year, in partnership with the Teach Foundation, we will release our third round of grant making, which are teacher impact grants. So these are the grants that we're all familiar with the Teach Foundation. And unlike the innovation grants that say, give us a big idea that can scale, the teacher impact grants ask, what do you need right now to support your existing instructional strategies or improve learning today in the classroom? And the teacher impact grants are $1,000 for an individual teacher or $5,000 for a team or a department of teachers. And again, that will be at the end of this calendar year. All right, so in addition to all that fun that we've been having, we've also been working very hard, as I mentioned at the last board meeting, on getting the foundation itself, getting the organization set up for success. And a couple key activities have been underway to get the organization properly established. So one of the things that we recently did, the foundation board made some updates to the foundation's bylaws. And included in those updates was a change, and the change was to our board composition. In the foundation's original bylaws, we had a permanent voting seat for a member of the school board and for the superintendent, who is the representative of the school board. After some discussion, there was consensus that it made more sense for those positions to be transitioned from voting members of the board to non-voting liaisons to our board. And the reason for that was twofold. One, having official voting representation from the school board created some complexity for the foundation board, which could cause us to have to function more like a public entity, which was not the intention at the outset. And so we wanted to clarify that the foundation continues to function as a private organization. And second of all, just resolve any complexity or conflicts that may arise from people wearing two hats with two different organizations. And so those the superintendent and the school board seat transitioned to non-voting representatives to the foundation. And then the second was not a change, it was an addition to our bylaws. We added a provision to our bylaws specific to the SB 1090 funds that codifies in our bylaws that those funds will be managed as an endowment. It is the commitment of the foundation board that we are good stewards of those funds and that we manage them as a legacy for this district, and that these funds remain there to grow over time and benefit students for generations to come. And so that endowment language was an add to our bylaws. The next thing that we did was we have been working for probably 6 months on a memorandum of understanding. And as we are getting this foundation set up, we are working to define, clarify, and formalize the working relationship between the foundation and the school district. And so we've known in practice how that relationship has been working, but we wanted to commit that to writing so that we had enduring document that would outlive our current foundation board, school board, staff, and be something that everyone, again, generations from now, can look back and say, okay, we understand the nature of this relationship, both in intent and in practice. And so I'll walk you through specifically some of the key elements of that MOU. If you look at that document, there's a section that specifically speaks to district responsibilities. In the district responsibilities, the district commits to share relevant information. That's so that our foundation board knows what your priorities are, knows what programs are in place, so that as we are developing strategies, we remain closely aligned and can have maximal impact. Also, the district provides space and equipment and staff support to the foundation, specifically having a designated staff position to serve as the executive director of the foundation, and that anytime there are funding requests from the district, that those funding requests come through established processes adopted by the foundation. And then we go into the foundation's responsibilities to the district. And so, first of all, we're going to commit to invest in programs and strategies that benefit the students of this district, that we will operate the foundation in compliance with applicable laws and regulations, that we will alert the district to any proposed changes to the foundation's bylaws or articles of incorporation, that we will provide an annual report to the school board, and that the foundation board will consult with the superintendent on the job performance for the executive director. So we've clarified in the MOU that the executive director position reports to the superintendent, but the foundation can provide input, but ultimately employment and management decisions reside with the superintendent. And then finally, we have the term, and this is a typo, and I apologize. This is a five-year term with automatic annual renewal, but there is annual review that's required. So the a representative of the foundation and the superintendent will sit down and review the MOU on an annual basis to identify if there are any changes that are required. It specifies that the district's funding, that it's a commitment of current year revenues only. Obviously, this board has the ability to adjust its level of support as the budget changes. In the event that there's a change to the district's level of support to the foundation, this agreement says that you will provide us provide the foundation notice of any changes to the level of funding, and that if there's a significant change in the level of funding, that that would be grounds for a review of the MOU. And then termination is if there's a material breach of the agreement, or if there's some change in tax law or some other change that would imperil the organization's 501c3. So with that, I'm going to pause and see if there are any questions.
Mr. Millar.
Just so I'm clear, so the $10 million from these community impact funds went to the district. The district, because it was earmarked for the foundation, has funded the foundation with that $10 million.
So I think it's a little bit, it's a nuanced arrangement. And you know, Dr. Prater or Ryan can jump in. As I understand the statute specifies that $10 million shall go to an education foundation for the benefit of the students of San Luis Coastal. Those monies, all of the mitigation funds are being remitted to the county, and the county is managing the allocations okay. to the respective parties. And so rather than the money passing through the school district, the $10 million will be going to the county, which will then release the funds directly to the foundation. So right now, the first installment of funding for the foundation is sitting over at the county and will come to the foundation once we have our investment manager in place and open an investment management account.
And this county office of ed that's handling the money?
Or no, it's actually the county of San Luis Obispo. So it's sitting in the county treasury at this time.
So I just wanted to make sure I understood that. You know, going through the MOU, for instance, 1G, this is part of the benefits that will accrue, is that the solicitation of additional revenue by foundation board and personnel reduces the fundraising burden on the superintendent, administrators, teachers, staff, leaving them more time to focus on teaching and staffing and stuff. So I was unaware of a burden upon our staff for fundraising. Was I missing something for these last 19 and a half years or something? Yeah. Should I have been out there fundraising? I didn't know. I just
didn't you write your check, Walter?
Anyway, I had a couple of questions. So part of the district's responsibility is to provide a director, which you. And then there are other personnel, non-specific personnel, material, office space requirements, but they're open-ended. There's no real way to figure out what the burden is going to be on the district. Right. So is there some idea of how many FTEs the foundation is going to require to...
Yeah, there's no significant FTE. There's the office space that's in my office. There's access to the copy machine when needed. There's partnered with the foundation where they're picking up an intern from Cal Poly to help with content development, and then we take a portion of that internship and use it for our purposes as well. So we have like a 50-50 deal. So it's minimal impact. There's no plan to hire additional staff.
Right.
If that were to change, we'd certainly bring it back to you. But at this point, it's an office. It's minimal minimal materials and equipment. And Christine is actually the executive director is actually in my office area and has a space right there in our in the main office.
Good. That helps. I some of these things just left me wondering, and I always figure if I'm wondering, then at least one or two other people may be wondering.
Can I talk a little bit about yours? Okay, sorry.
Okay, so I was just going to go down this list, Mark.
Yeah, no problem.
So in part three, subpart small d, the foundation agrees that it will continue to recognize the district as the primary beneficiary of the solicitation program. That language bothered me a little bit because what reason would there be for the foundation to exist if they started to recognize some other entity as the beneficiary?
Yeah, so this language actually was the subject of a lot of discussion and was pretty intentional. And the reason was we have had a lot of conversations about how can San Luis Coastal do things that might attract bigger dollars and interest from out-of-area partners or funders. And the biggest opportunity for us to do that is looking at programs that have the potential for scale. So whereas our grant making is laser-focused on replication scale across our district, there may be a scenario where we can have amplified impact and better compete for dollars through collaboration with other districts or other schools. And so I think some of the CTE work is a good example of that, where this district became more competitive for CTE dollars because of a regional collaboration. And so what we don't want to do is preclude ourselves from working in a way that is primarily, you know, number one benefit needs to be to San Luis Coastal. But if there are additional ancillary benefits that result from our work, we want to have the ability to engage in collaborations and partnerships.
Okay, it doesn't quite say that in the language, but nope. I hear what you're saying. It actually says that the foundation, the district will be the primary beneficiary as long as the district is in compliance with the agreement and that such designation does not jeopardize tax exempt or legal status of the foundation. So would we get to examine this potential collaboration that you're talking about that may at least shift some of the focus to the district as the primary beneficiary?
So what I mean, all of the programs that we are, that would be contemplated, either things that are in progress now or work that I can imagine the foundation undertaking, anything that touches the district is being developed in close partnership with the district. There have been no strategies that have been contemplated that are not being developed in close coordination with the district. And the foundation board has been very explicit that we recognize one of our greatest assets is the close integration of the foundation with the school district. And we hear that not only from our board, but from donors, that that gives us a competitive advantage. And so we want to be highly protective of that. And everything that we do needs to demonstrate impact. And we can't demonstrate impact if we're not closely partnered with the district with programs that can be implemented and implemented at a high, high quality. So, yes, the district would be involved in the design, not just the review, but I would say backing it up in the design of programs.
Okay. And then in the part three, subparagraph small e, the foundation has a fiduciary responsibility for the operation of the foundation and the authorization of the expenditures of funds. And it goes on to say that the foundation is responsible for providing the assisting district employee any necessary training, et cetera. So part of this is structure. Part of this is kind of what I do sometimes. But it struck me as odd that the paragraph where you take on the responsibility as a fiduciary, which are significant responsibilities, and then the second sentence goes into to whoever the employee the district has to provide, we're going to, you know, we'll be, the foundation would be responsible for training. I just thought it was an odd combination of items, because the fiduciary part is huge. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad to see that it's in there. I'm just running through some things that struck me when I was reviewing this earlier. And this is subpart G of number 3, and that deals with the foundation shall consult the district before accepting any gift designated for the benefit of the district if that gift contains restrictive terms or conditions or violates our district's policy. So, which is fine, and I'm glad we're doing it, because that is something that worries me. But then goes on to say, similarly, the foundation shall have, as provided the foundation from time to time, then similarly, the foundation shall have the exclusive right to accept or reject proposed gifts which violate its gift acceptance policy. Mm-hmm. So its gift acceptance policy refers to the foundation's.
Correct. So the foundation has a gift acceptance policy that has different tiers of review. So there are certain scenarios in which we're saying we simply will not accept a gift under certain conditions. And then other scenarios where it would be subject to review, and then another category that is non-controversial and we would not subject it to review. You know, somebody that wants to give a $20 online contribution, we would not subject that to review. So we have that policy. One of the things that we're recognizing here is, in addition to our policy, if there is a donor request or a condition on that gift that in any way asks the district to do something that is inconsistent with your existing gift policy, or if somebody wants to put a name on an auditorium, that's not the purview of the foundation. We have no authority, no standing to enter into that type of gift agreement. And so there are certain things that we can do on our side that are exclusive to the foundation if it's a benefit that is on our organization and does not ask anything of the school district. In the event that we want to go a step further and we have a donor that wants some type of engagement or recognition that's not ours to give, that needs to come to the school board and go through your process, and you are the decision maker in that scenario.
Okay, and that gets me back to what I was, my concern is, it says you're going to, the foundation is going to consult with the district about any gifts that might violate our policies, and this is not hypothetical. This has happened. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't say in there that the district can say, no, you're not going to accept this gift, because it does violate our policy.
So in that, I mean, theoretically, I guess we could accept the gift. We wouldn't be able to perform on the gift. And so if a condition of the gift was a recognition and we contractually entered into a gift agreement where we commit to a donor to provide recognition that we cannot provide, that puts us in legal violation of that agreement. And so you still, as the school board, retain all of the legal controls over what types of activities or recognitions you provide, and you have your policies for that. And
yes, so, but can we tell you not to accept a gift because of whatever requirements or things?
So
can
we,
our policies control?
Yeah. No. So your policies could not stop the foundation from accepting a gift to the foundation. You could stop the foundation from engaging in a program, activity, or providing a donor recognition that was part of the donor intent for that gift.
Okay. Well, you know, what's come up in the past is not recognition for the donor or that. It's been, I want this money used at this school
sure.
site.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the things that I'm concerned about,
right.
because especially with the mechanism for awarding grants and
right.
things, you could,
mm-hmm.
you know, there's.
Yeah.
I think it's great. Those yep. are wonderful grants, but, you know, we want to be equitable across our district.
Absolutely.
We have a fiduciary obligation to do that. Mm-hmm. So that just made me wonder, because the language does not actually confer on the district the right to say, no, don't take this gift. Yeah. It's just, so, you just are going to consult with us.
Right. So I think that gets back to the idea that the district has ultimate control over performance on the gift. So what we can do is theoretically receive funds. We cannot deliver program. And so if a donor came to us and said, I would like to provide funds for a program specific to a school site, we could take the money, but we cannot compel the school site to do something if the district has said, we're not going to partner with the foundation in this effort and we're not going to receive the funds.
Okay. So does the district have a mechanism, let's say we have a collapse in home values and we're strapped for general fund money, does the district have a mechanism to come to the foundation and say, we would like $500 million this year? No, not $500 million. $500,000, sorry. Get busy on that fundraising. So we, because otherwise we've got a large cohort of kindergartners coming in. Is there a mechanism for us to have you guys enhance our general fund for a particular year on an episodic basis?
Yeah, so the answer is yes and no. So there is a mechanism for the district to request funds. So the process would be that the district would initiate a funding request that would be subject to review and approval by the foundation board using our existing review processes. However, the amount of funding that the foundation would be in a position to provide would heavily influence our ability to respond to that request. So because the SB 1090 funds are being managed as an endowment, with all of our spending being from the growth of that endowment, we are not reaching into the corpus of the funds. And so the ability to say, you know, we have a budget shortfall, we need $10 million, the foundation would not be able to go raid the endowment and pull out $10
million. Okay.
If there are funds in our available-to-spend account, or if the foundation said, that is a very compelling cause, we want to be front line of rallying the community to invest in whatever that budget shortfall is, and we will go out and initiate a campaign for that, then what I would envision and what the board has actually talked about around this theme is, you know, really trying to marshal community resources and meet needs as they arise through some type of targeted fundraising campaign that would be partnered with the school board to tell that story to the community.
Okay. Thank you. It's been very helpful. I yield the floor.
Mr. Buckman.
Yeah. So I want to thank Walter for his expertise in contracts and his questions, and I think they actually raise other questions for me. So before I ask some questions, as I read it and as I understand the foundation, and the best example I can give in my mind is we're making an MOU that's in some ways similar to making an MOU with a charter school. So we have some limited authority and input on the charter school, but really not very much on their programs, their hiring, who they hire. And in what I read here is the foundation is in reality a entire separate nonprofit, an entirely separate entity. And while I appreciate the comment from Dr. Prater, well, if that happens, we'll bring it back, I don't see a mechanism. It was one of Walter's comments, and I can't remember which one, Walter, but it was a great question. And the response was, well, we'll bring that back if that happens. And I don't see a mechanism in the MOU to do that. So that's just one thought at this point.
So you're correct that the foundation is an independent 501c3, and the MOU is a document that defines and formalizes a close working relationship between two independent organizations.
Okay. So that leads me into some other questions, if that's the basis for it. Let me see if I can get – I've made so many notes now, I'm not sure. When we talked about the number of employees and Walter's question to the full-time FTEs, So full-time employment is one thing, but there could be a number of people who are paid to do other work for the foundation. And I believe that may have happened this summer, where six teachers did some input on a project, and I believe that the district paid them for doing that work. Just yeah. A question.
Yeah, so actually in that case, the teachers were compensated for their time. They were not compensated by the district.
Okay.
They were compensated by a grant from Cal Poly.
Okay.
And so the foundation was able to partner with a faculty member at Cal Poly and engage teachers to collaborate with us in a research initiative. And so it was a three-way partnership between Cal Poly, the school district, and the foundation.
And I appreciate that. But so to my question, and I'm sorry that example didn't work.
Oh, no.
To my question is... And to Walter's is, there's really nothing in here. So we pay, the board, district pays the salaries for whatever staff the foundation has, according to the MOU, the way it is now. And so if, and within the bylaws of the foundation, it says that you can have as many committees as you need, which is appropriate, but there can be people that are outside the directors to be on those committees. So my concern is the same as Walter's. If we're paying for the people that work for the foundation, I don't see the cap on it, and that concerns me as well.
Yeah. So, do you want
to? Yeah. One thing I did not mention is that any additional staffing, which we have no plans for at all, but if there were to be a need, a perceived need, I would bring that before the board to approve. So anything that we would add to this foundation, the cost from the district to support the director would go before the board for approval, if that's what we were to do.
So within the foundation's bylaws, when it comes down to, I think, in the membership clause, it says that the foundation, the board of directors can actually hire. First of all, they can set, if they wanted to, they could set compensation for themselves. But it also, I can find it. So, but the one thing that really scared me in there was the possible perception that would be bad for the foundation and also for directors in the foundation, that says if needed, the foundation board could hire a director with expertise in a certain area and pay that person to do that kind of work.
So in the compensation section of the bylaws, it says the board of directors may not compensate directors for their services as directors. And then there's a provision that says that directors may be reimbursed for actual expenses incurred for services related to their role as a director, so if they travel, et cetera.
Keep going.
So it says the corporation may also pay directors a per diem rate, consistent with the IRS code. Oh, I see. Is it this, a director may be paid for legal or accounting services actually rendered to the corporation?
I think it's a little further down. I mean, I can do a word search if I can call it.
Here we go.
Out.
Okay. So the corporation may also pay directors for actual services rendered to the corporation in the director's usual occupation, so legal or accounting.
Right. So a director could be paid for work that they have expertise in, so in this case, accounting and something else. For us as a board, that would be a conflict. That would be seen as a conflict of interest, sort of a major one. So I'm not sure, is that okay with the IRS? Is that okay with you guys? Because it's kind of not okay with me.
Yeah, so we do have conflict of interest policies. These types of conflicts, some boards manage them with disclosure, and that would be something that the board would have to look at very carefully. If there was, this has not come up as a situation that our board is contemplating, and knowing our board, I strongly suspect that we would do everything in our power to steer far clear of this scenario. But as you know, bylaws are broadly written to cover a whole host of scenarios and be an enduring document that contemplates a number of hypothetical situations. And so that specific language, again, in our bylaws, allows for a situation where we need some expert skill that we cannot find anywhere but a board member, and then you would have to go through a process that's consistent with conflict of interest policies and manage disclosure.
Okay, and I appreciate the comment, and specifically the comment that you couldn't find elsewhere, and the two items that was legal and accounting?
Those were examples, right.
They're examples. Mm-hmm. Okay. I appreciate that the bylaws need to be broad,
right.
But there are certain things that I think go beyond broad, and that's actually fairly specific. Mm-hmm. And so I just need to share with you again, that really scares me, that the board of directors of the foundation could actually hire themselves to do work for the foundation.
Yeah.
And that money, I'm going to just assume, are they staff? Or is that foundation money, or is the district ultimately paying them?
Yeah, so the foundation cannot pass to the district any expense. You know, the only expenses that the district would incur were expenses that went through a district process and were board or district approved. And so any expenses that the foundation is incurring that we have initiated not in partnership with the district are expenses for the foundation and the foundation alone to cover. And, you know, what I will say about this document, and I should have led with this at the beginning just to kind of set the stage for the process that has unfolded over the last 6 months, is both for the bylaws as well as the MOU that you have before you today. We do have two independent organizations. It's a unique relationship that we are working to define, and because of the potential complexities, it's been very important to us that we go slow and look deeply at all of these issues and questions, and that we do it with a lot of different eyes on the language. And so we started this process with a boilerplate MOU that's been used by other school districts and school foundations, and then we began a process of really tailoring and customizing that document to reflect this unique relationship and what our goals are here locally in our community in this district. And, you know, as we worked with the foundation board, the district staff, to craft that document, the district had legal counsel that represented the interests just of the district in that process. The foundation board had legal counsel that represented the interests of the foundation as an independent entity. And then there was a third attorney who came in whose expertise is representing nonprofits. And that third counsel came in not to represent the interests of either or organization, but instead to represent the partnership intent of this, and to look at this document and ask, not does it advocate for the interests of one or the other organization, but does this capture the spirit of this close integrated working relationship that we want this MOU to define? And so there were three different attorneys that walked through this process with us and have reviewed both the MOU as well as the foundation's bylaws. And so these bylaws have been scrubbed, looked through very carefully by those three attorneys. So we had a team of legal counsels all looking from slightly different perspectives, but making sure that we were landing in a place that captured shared goals.
Okay. So I think it's great that we had all these attorneys, but it's still, we're still the ones that have to sign this, and I feel pretty strongly about this because this is a lot of money. And again, this is a total separate entity, and you're going to be out sort of representing us to the community. Mm-hmm. There's a chance for the perception that things are wrong, like the conflict of interest that I mentioned, and it's not good for that director, and it's not good for the foundation. It may not be good for the board for that kind of perception to be out there. So I have I can't remember if it's the MOU or the bylaws. Within one of those documents, it talks about excluding
the board's representative from having information.
Yeah,
and
so you're referencing.
That sort of scares me.
Yeah, so you're referencing a section in the bylaws, and this is the section of the bylaws that speaks to the school board representative to the foundation. And so, as opposed to being a voting member, the sort of term of art that's being used is this is an observer to the foundation that has an open invitation to participate in the foundation's meetings, have access to information about the foundation's activities. There is language in there that very narrowly constrains our ability to exclude the district observer from a meeting or from having access to information. And so the two very narrow conditions under which the foundation would not provide information to a district representative would be that individual's attendance or providing them with information would adversely affect the attorney-client privilege between the foundation and our counsel, or would result in disclosure of trade secrets. And so, you know, the intention there was to have the two most constrained situations, very similar, you know, probably more narrow than your school board's closed session. And so when we get down into legal situations, and really if you look at those, it speaks to a potential collision of organizations where there was something happening that our foundation board needed to talk to our council about that had there was a conflict between the two entities.
Okay.
Very narrow.
And I see that as a very broad opening to keep to separate the two entities. However, that's just my interpretation. I appreciate it. However, then I have a question. We have this ability to seclude our board's representative. And I appreciate that. However, how many district employees sit on the board?
So right now,
with voting rights,
we have three. We have Mr. Mayfield, Kimberly McGrath, and Ryan Pinkerton.
Okay, so if we're going to exclude the board's rep, but have the
it's interesting.
Just seems silly. I don't know. So I'm going to end my questions there because evidently people are smiling about it. And I appreciate it.
I just have a quick follow-up.
Mr. Malone?
Has your board discussed doing an annual audit?
Yes.
Independent auditing agency?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, so we're actually in that process right now of initiating our Form 990 tax filings and our first year audit.
Mr. Buckman, did you have another question? Dr. Prater, you look like you wanted to say something.
Yeah, I just would like to clarify that tonight is about really about either is really about acting on the MOU, taking action on the MOU. Mm-hmm. We can share the bylaws, the concerns that were shared by Mr. Buckman regarding the bylaws with the foundation board.
Of course.
And I believe they would receive that feedback well. Mm-hmm. And certainly I didn't catch that part, but it's great feedback. And the bylaws belong in the domain of the foundation board. Mm-hmm. And I think that is great feedback. Mm-hmm. But tonight, unless the board wishes to push it off another meeting, tonight's really about the MOU, which we're looking for approval on.
Yeah, and so one of the reasons that we've gone through this very lengthy process, and we are eager to get the MOU established, and our board acted on this at our meeting on September 17th. The foundation board voted to approve this MOU. And they are desiring to have this in place because we are moving very quickly through the process of getting our investment manager in place so that we can receive the first installment of SB 1090 funds. And we would very much like to have the MOU in place before the foundation takes receipt of those funds.
Right. So this is on the agenda as an action item for tonight to approve the MOU with the foundation. Is there anyone from the public wishing to discuss this? Thank you. So at this time, I would ask if the board is ready to make a motion on this or to see what happens if a motion is proposed.
I move to approve the MOU with the San Luis Coastal Education Foundation.
I'll second.
All right, we have a motion by Mr. Unger, a second by Mr. Millar. Is there any further discussion?
Yeah, I'm just going to raise this. I think a number of questions have been raised. I think Mr. Millar's questions were great. I'm not sure that they were answered in a way that assures me that they'll be addressed and that they don't need to be in the MOU. So, A, I'm going to vote against the motion, but B, I really don't see the harm of bringing this back. There's just questions that have been raised, I think, that need to be addressed.
We have a motion and a second, so we need to act on that, unless you're changing your view. All right, then I would ask for a vote at this time, all in favor of supporting, approving the MOU with the foundation.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Mr. Weckman. Okay, thank you. Motion carries 4-1 with our two absences.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right. 9.05 is a discussion item on the culture of care and school safety, district safety preparedness update number one.
Number one. So yeah, we've dove into the board's priority on safety at all of our sites. In particular, as Dr. Prater has talked to the board about previously, you know, we've been kind of using the background that was provided by Safe Schools, which two founders from Sandy Hook who unfortunately had children that were killed in that active shooter situation there. So that's Alyssa Parker and Michelle Gay put together the Safe and Sound Schools. And it just really resonated with us in terms of their overall kind of look at safety and really kind of changing the culture of safety in the district. And it wasn't just about active shooter. It was about all aspects of safety. And so what we've done is the board has hired Resolute, which is two of our former fire chiefs in the area, Garrett Olson for San Luis City, as well as Robert Lewin with the county. And they have been excellent for me in terms of helping me kind of get this going and establishing it. So this presentation was actually put together, and I just kind of took I basically condensed it because it was about an hour-long presentation. So I took some of the main slides that I wanted to share with the board tonight. But this was something that we went through this with all each of the pillar teams. So the six pillars that you'll see on the first slide, mental and behavioral health and wellness, physical environment, culture, climate, community, school law, policy, and finance, and operations and emergency management. So those are the six pillars that Safe Schools has kind of established to kind of have that whole emergency readiness structure, and they're very broad each way. So next slide. Again, the focus with Rob and Garrett was really to look at that mission, right? And so the mission is to support school crisis prevention, response, and recovery, and to protect every school, every student, every day. And so, again, that broad look at all the different aspects. So everything from, are kids eating? Or are they getting lunch? Do they have the counseling support that they have in the classrooms? And really not just looking at kind of after the fact that something has happened, but really what are the preventive strategies we can use? And then what if something does happen, what are we doing to protect our students? And then actual recovery after the fact. So it's really this broad look at all the different aspects that we go through. And so we met with each of the pillar teams, as I talked about. The meeting objectives for each team was kind of discuss the variety of emergency threats that the district might face. And ultimately look at, hey, what do we want this to be when we're done with this year-long, you know, kind of focus on safety? What are those end results? What, you know, okay, a school safety plan, but what else is it? Do we want, is it survey results? Is it everyone being able to, understand how to use our new PA system with our phones, or like what are those end deliverables that we want to make sure? And so that was one of the things that we talked, each group kind of went through their focus area and what we wanted that end state of emergency preparedness to look like. Again, the deliverables to the district, which is something that I'll be reporting back to the school board periodically over the course of the year, kind of sharing kind of where we're at, what we've come up with, and again, then going out and taking that out to our sites and making sure that our teachers, our parents, our community understands the different aspects of safety. And then ultimately, the goal was to look at each pillar team and discuss kind of, what are we doing now? What's missing? What are the different needs? So Rob and Garrett kind of talked about three different types of emergency situations that we need to look at, right? So one is your general emergency. Something happens, and this happens every day at our school sites, right? Whether it's a student gets hurt on the playground, whether it's, we have a fire in one of our classrooms, right? Today we had smoke at one of the restrooms at Teach Elementary School after school. So, that's an emergency that happens, right? How do we handle that? How are we dealing with that? What's our plan? What's our strategies to do that? But we need to not just be, able to answer to emergency situations. What if there's a disaster that happens? And so a disaster is something that affects an entire community potentially, right? So something like the mudslides that happened in Santa Barbara and Montecito, right? That was, kind of a disaster for that area. But you could go a mile north, a mile south. I mean, those communities weren't affected. It was just that one community, right? So are we prepared in San Luis Coastal to deal with a disaster that might come up? And then ultimately, what if there's something really bad, catastrophic event that happens where EMS, emergency workers, aren't able to get to all of our school sites at one time? Are we prepared for that? And so our focus has been to be able to deal with each of the different levels and different types of emergency situations that might come up. So the next slide kind of talks about, kind of walked us through the different components of emergency, right, and what would be considered successful or us being successful in making sure that we're prepared. And it was interesting for they showed kind of this, preparedness lasts a long time, right? Like we should always be constantly working on being prepared and looking at our plans and what we're doing. You can go all the way to slide 5, Mandy. And then ultimately, the act that happens is really a small part of time, right? That's the an active shooter is like I think 2 minutes or something, like very little time, or an earthquake that might happen, or whatever that situation disaster happens is actually a small period of time. And then afterwards, are we prepared for short term? What are we going to do? Are we prepared for the intermediate time period and then the long term planning, right? So what we heard from going to the Save a Town conference with Michelle Gay and Melissa Parker was that the toughest part was the recovery phase. That they were prepared for everything that happened that day, but they weren't prepared for the long, path that they headed, in dealing with the community and those issues that they faced, and relocation centers, and where parents were supposed to pick up their kids, and how did they handle counselors at those days, all those things, right? And that's where Rob and Garrett, for me, are huge assistants, because they've been through these emergencies, they've dealt with the situation, and so they're helping us kind of put that plan together and make sure that we're prepared for all of the different phases of an emergency situation. Recently, we just signed up through the federal government to put together a hazmat plan for our district, hazmat mitigation plan. So I actually just got word yesterday that our first kind of step in that application process was approved. So we're going to go forward with the application, which is about $50,000 worth of funds for the district to put that plan together. There's a county local community hazmat plan, but what we found, and Rob kind of dug into it a little bit, was that we actually, as a school district, have to have our own plan in order to potentially receive federal funds should some type of major emergency happen. So we're going to move forward and get that accomplished. So the different variety of threats, one thing that they really focused on with us, with each of the groups, is that, right now it's active shooter. Everything public, active shooter, active shooter, active shooter. But the reality is that there's all kinds of threats and emergency situations that we might face in our district. So Morro Bay High is in a 100-year flood zone. So 1/100th every year, there's a chance that it could flood, right? We've had, school bus incidents where students were, doing a college visit and a bus crashed. There's the fires that happened up north. There are lockdowns. There's the Northridge earthquake that happened, the bottom picture, and even our own Diablo Canyon, which is the one we focus a lot in terms of our own safety preparedness. But their goal is that, end of the day, deliverable-wise, we're going to be prepared for each of those situations and in all the different phases. Ultimately, we want to protect our kids, right? We want to protect our students, but we also want to protect our staff and our classrooms and our school sites. And so we just kind of talked with the groups, with the different pillar groups on, making sure that we're keeping this in mind as we move forward. Mrs. Frame had some excellent questions today about, where do volunteers fit into this plan. And so that's part of what happens when we meet as a pillar group and they start to discuss this. And, well, what about volunteers? What about, the pool at Morro Bay, and we have community members there. There's all those things that we need to think about as we put these plans together. So the next phase is just kind of, I'm not going to go through each one, but it's just each of the pillars. And so the board can see, so they've kind of put together a description of each pillar, right? So the mental and behavioral health pillar was mental and behavioral health of our school community is essential to the overall safety. When a student, staff, or family member experiences depression, addiction, anxiety, or even contemplates self-harm or suicide, the person and those around them are more prone to harm. So that is one of our pillars that we're looking at. So we have, kind of two key individuals. I believe this is Diane Frost, and Chris Dowler, and so they're kind of leading that pillar along with all of our administrators, or have kind of been broken up into the different pillars as well. And so we just started to list things we currently have in place. We're going to dig down more in terms of what each of those things mean. Again, what do we have? What do we need? What do we need to add to? And even in those discussions with administrators, it became really clear the fact that we need to communicate these things, right, to everyone. So Aaron Black was a high school, administrator and knew how to call crisis intervention because he had dealt with it at the high school with a student. Well, the other elementary principals had no idea. Crisis intervention team, what is that? And, so again, it just kind of, the reason why we're doing this focus is to make sure that everyone's on the same page. Everyone understands kind of what's happening. So, again, each one just kind of goes through the different pillars. I'm not going to go through each of them, but we have a lot that's there for safe, for in terms of safety. We do have a lot tied into our system already. And Rob and Garrett are going to help us just kind of put that together as a good plan that ultimately, I see us kind of going through and making sure that our employees – man, if you go to slide 14, that people are knowledgeable, right? And we got to figure out how are we going to share certain information with parents through Parent Square, through our website, so that we're prepared should any type of emergency happen. And this last slide I wanted to share with the board was just kind of it was an interesting conversation that we had with each of the administrators, and that is where are your parents, where are your staff when we look at this chart? And it was interesting to kind of hear the different, talk about different people that are on different realms, right? And we have, in San Luis Coastal, this is San Luis Obispo. That'll never happen here, right? So we have those individuals. And then we have the other people that, oh my God, we have to put a bucket in every classroom, and we have to do, you know, and there's whenever an incident happens, we always, the overreaction the next day that occurs, right? And so our goal is to get kind of everyone in that blue zone, right, where there's kind of this active awareness about what's happening. We're not going to overreact to certain situations, but we're going to ensure that we're prepared, that we are doing whatever we need to do to make sure that our students are safe and our staff is safe. So it was just kind of I think this is a good chart to share with staff and kind of talk about what level they're at, where they're at, to make sure that, you know, we want people to take this in so that we do change the culture of our school district when we talk about these items. So lastly, we actually have our leader meeting coming up October 4th, where we're going to kind of take the input from each of those pillar team meetings that we had, and we're going to look at, okay, how does this all blend together, right? So these deliverables that we're going to look for, we don't need, you know, different pillar teams doing the same thing, right? We want to make sure that each team has kind of their set goals and focus and what they're going to bring back, and then we'll be, again, sharing that kind of with the board and looking at the overall plans as we move forward. We actually just got done meeting with the Sheriff's Department and the City of Morro Bay today, looking at SROs and SRO duties and responsibilities. We'll be meeting with the San Luis Obispo Police Department, and we really wanted to make sure that the upper kind of staff at each of those organizations knew that we're going to be working with our SROs, doing site visits, looking at facilities, and really good conversations, really good kind of tie-in. And they're actually really excited that each of the different agencies, you know, we're kind of weird in that we have the county, city mm-hmm. of Morro Bay, city of San Luis Obispo. So really to make sure that we're all tied together, it's important that we get everybody talking.
Thank you. Is there anyone from the public here to discuss this? Right. I see Mr. Buckman and then Mr. Millar.
Thanks. It's the second time I had the opportunity to hear this. Ryan was able to present this to the parent leaders, and it was an eye-opener for me because I'm, like, focusing on individual emergencies. Mm-hmm. So this was real, but it was really nice to see the parents get it, that this is, it's a much bigger issue.
Yeah.
So I just, thanks, Ryan. I
think the parents were very excited that this was a board priority.
Yeah, and I don't know how many more times you have to do it, but
it's okay.
The two you did was great.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Millar.
So what is the RAVE app?
So the RAVE app is the app the Sheriff's Department has in terms of, in this, so that's the basically an active intruder kind of situation where people, and again, it's a voluntary basis for staff to have that on their phones if they want to have it. It's one of the things that is going to come out of this in terms of how is that coordinated with the school district. Perfect. So and to ensure that you know, whatever plans or however the RAVE app works, that it doesn't, you know, negatively affect what we're doing at our school site. But it's definitely something that you know, there's a lot of bugs still in terms of that process.
I just want to make sure, but I'm glad to hear you say that, because it has the potential to add to chaos or to hopefully with the right procedures and processes, you know, help figure things out. I have
Agreed.
To say, as a somewhat of a skeptic, having done some of this stuff in a previous millennium and always reluctant to compliment firefighters, I was very impressed with this analysis and the comprehensiveness of it, and I'm feeling better all the time about Resolute and our decision.
Thank you.
You know, I just wanted to make a brief comment that one of the things I enjoy about our district as a whole is that we encourage our schools to have their own culture and mm-hmm. to have their own independent, make their own stamp, their own individual stamp. But I appreciate that when it comes to something like this, that we really need a comprehensive plan that is the same throughout our system, so that every site we know has the same information will operate in a similar manner with the same level of confidence and knowledge about how things work, and especially when we bring in the complexity of all these law enforcement and first responder organizations that exist just in our relatively small district. It ups the level a great deal in terms of complexity, and I'm hoping that they are all working together so that their responses will match what our sites are learning and what to do and how to do things, because in a large event, an earthquake or something that goes throughout the district or affects many schools, everyone's going to need to know that they're operating together. But I really appreciate that this is an area where we say everyone has to do this the same way.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's important. So thank you. Oh yes, I'm sorry.
So everyone's pointing at me. It's okay.
Yeah. No. Thank you.
No. This is a great presentation, Mr. Oh, is that better? Okay. This is a great presentation, and thanks for addressing about the volunteers. The other thing is, and this relates to what Ellen was saying about. I don't know if it falls under the purview of hiring or. The substitute, as you said, that making sure that protocol is the same across sites, so a sub, whatever school they go to, but also, sometimes we have difficulty with, filling, so do we look at that policy again and say, if a school wants to go to a training, limit the staff that what that looks like in the advent of, an emergency. And the other thing, and the final, will there be dollars? Will we get some kind of a budget about what will be needed for, I'm thinking of that slide 8, that the supports we have, and, you're going to look at right now, this is just conceptual, but,
I think ultimately it's to, again, there's all kinds of different parts of this. One is kind of our overall safety plan, right? From emergency to catastrophe, what's that plan look like? Where will our command center be? Who will command the command center? Where will be the relocation centers? All of that would be a plan. Now, the other part is, as we go through this, is kind of, okay, there's going to be a lot of questions, right? So our physical plants. We have C.L. Smith now, perfect. One entry point, fencing, those types of things. We don't have that at our other sites. So there's going to be, hey, we think all sites should have the following, and there will be budget numbers attached. I'm assuming that mental behavioral health will be looking at our counseling programs, and are they meeting the needs of our kids? Should we add? Should we, be changing the way that we do things instead of working with this group? Should we do this? Or, those conversations will happen. And if there's needs associated with those, then those would be, hey, that'll be something that we'll bring forward that, hey, we think we should add, these supports and have some type of budget to it. But realizing that it's all... it's already kind of part of our LCAP. It's already part of our school budget. So we're going to have to be careful in terms of additions. But it's still, as things come up, if there's needs that we have, we need to share that with the board. And if those need to be funding priorities, then, we should bring them forward.
Would this be something the foundation could, or no, that's completely... separate entity.
So again, the foundation kind of, it's a lot of every time we have a need, it's, hey, could the foundation do that part of it, right? So,
okay, sorry.
It's whether that's a priority for the foundation. It could be, right? It could be something that they come, that they look at. Again, I think kind of the MOU today, whatever the board's priorities are, is something that the foundation should be looking at when they look at what they should fund. So could it be? Yeah, it could be, right? They have to transition whatever that is to donors. Mm-hmm.
So they have to be able to take whatever the, you know, programs they're setting up and go get people to give money for that. So, you know, whether that is something that people would give and move forward with, you know, that's a whole another conversation.
Thank you.
Sure.
All right. Again, this was a not an action item. So
I'll be back.
You'll be back. All right. Thank you. Next, we have three board policies, first readings. It's my understanding none of these are urgent. We can bring them all forward after discussing them tonight for a second reading. Is that correct?
We absolutely could.
Thank you. So first, I'll just carry on. You can
sure.
Take it from here.
So first, we'll take a look at board policy 0420, which is school plans, which you will see, I believe, at your next board meeting. So you will see a reminder, just the all the red lines are the suggestions from CSBA. You will see purple adjustments, which means that it was additions or edits from your subcommittee, and this did follow through the typical process. The subcommittee did notice that a lot of the additions from GAMET are processes that you currently abide by as the board. You annually review and update school plans for student achievement. They did make a switch there as you annually review, so that the subcommittee just made sure to spell that out. And then also decided to look at removing whether there's any materials or substantial revisions, because we do expect these plans to be living documents that the school looks at, monitors progress around, adjust as needed, and the subcommittee really saw that as it's the school's work to continue to make those adjustments as needed. So tonight would be the first reading for this board policy, and your typical practice has been to bring this back for a second reading.
Any questions from the board? Discussion? All right. Public? No. Okay. I'll keep asking you. next.
Right. The next one, we have board policy 5141.52. This is a student policy on suicide prevention. You will notice the purple changes are a lot of suggestions from the subcommittee to move that content, that it would be better suited in an AR. So the subcommittee is great about saying, you know, the board really determines what, and then it's really the AR that should be defining how that takes place. And so the pattern seems to be that sometimes it gets way too specific within the BP. So you'll see a lot of those adjustments suggested to move to the AR. I will note that Mr. Unger did notice that under the staff development section, the way that paragraph ends, it says, in cooperation with one or more community mental health agencies. Really, there should probably be a period there, because it said it may include information on, and there was a colon, but we did remove all of the numbered details. So I would suggest that revision, that good catch. So again, this is first reading. I would suggest your typical practice is to bring back for a second reading after anyone from the public would have time to view.
Any board discussion? Nothing from you. Thank you. All right. And the last one, Kimberly.
Great. We do have one final, board policy 5144.1. This is a student board policy around suspension and expulsion. You know that as you have a safety goal, a lot of this initial information kind of aligns with that and sets that up in red from GAMET. You'll see some specific adjustments that really called out our restorative justice practices and what we believe is great in working with students. It also further defines a student expulsion by the board, and you'll see a lot of addition there. Again, I would suggest to bring this back as a second reading.
Any board discussion on this one? All right, and nothing from you. All right, we will look forward to seeing these at our next meeting on the action consent agenda.
Great, thank you.
Thank you. All right, moving on to the action consent agenda, I will list the items. If anyone wants anything pulled, please let me know. 10.01, acceptance of donations. 10.02, approval of warrants and payroll.
Can you please pull that?
10.03, approval of certificated and classified personnel items. 10.04, approval of purchase orders and CalCard purchases. 10.05, approval of furniture and equipment request. 10.06, proposed revisions to board policy 0450, comprehensive safety plan, second reading.
Move approval of items 10.01, 10.03 to 10.06.
We have a motion by Mr. Unger, second by Mr. Millar. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. And Mr. Buckman, you requested pulling 10.02.
Yes, so if we have another half hour, I'd like to. I've got a few questions. Bad joke. Okay. I have two small items on this. I noted as I was reading this that our trash, there's two items, and it amounts, and I need to ask a question, Ryan. So would those amounts, $27,000 waste pickup by the city, I added it all up, and $23,000 by Los Osos Community Service District, is that a monthly amount? Is it possible that's a bi-monthly? Because right now it would work out at 10 months, it would work out to $500,000 to pick up trash.
Are you looking at the city San Luis Obispo Utilities Waste?
Yep. And then later on, Los Osos Community Service District.
You know, I'll have to find out.
Yeah, okay.
Let you know. Yeah.
I appreciate that.
What was the other one, Los Osos?
Community Service District is about, and that's another thing, is that the Community Service
water.
District.
I'm sure it's water, sewer, but
okay.
Let me double check and make sure.
Thanks. And then I noticed that we have like a million electric meters.
We have what?
We have like a million electric meters. There's like PG. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if we could maybe get a look at that by site, so we can maybe look at one elementary school is doing this and another elementary school is doing that. We're looking at climate and all that. Okay. Mm-hmm. And then the last one was U.S. Bank. There's like a ton of entries for U.S. Bank. And
That's our credit card.
Yeah, and I got that. Mm-hmm. And I'd like one of those credit cards if I get a chance.
Yep.
But I'm looking at U.S. Bank versus, would it be possible to look at possibly using a local bank? Because U.S. Bank is huge. So those are my...
You'll have to find out about CalCards.
Okay,
and
thanks.
How CalCards work in terms of why U.S. Bank is the group.
Thanks. So sure. I would move approval of 10.02.
But I have a question before asking Mr. Pinkerton to do some of this work. That we need to make sure that it's that the board is in agreement before you start breaking down, you know, site electric meters and things like that. So I just would like to see if that's something that everyone is interested before asking him to perform this work.
So, Ellen, go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, I'm thinking about what Mrs. Sheffer's saying, and as a board member, I don't think that's something that I need to know about that deeply. I would expect that's the kind of thing that the maintenance, that the M&O department would be looking at consistently, trying to figure out ways to... trying to look at ways to conserve energy. In fact, I believe we've had several energy audits, have we not? And I'm assuming that's continuing. So I have no need to know that.
So Mr. Buckman, yeah, please.
Yeah, just so often a board member will make a request for information, so I'm just hoping that they're treated the same way each time.
Well, I think what I'm trying to do is be consistent here, and this sounds like something that could take quite a bit of time. So,
right, if we're asking, my thought is if we're asking this on behalf of the board, then I think the board needs to make a decision on whether this is information the board wants. If it is an individual board member asking it, then that would be an individual board member asking the administration for that, as in the 1-7 process, I believe.
So I guess under 1-7, but and I also know we're going to be clarifying this at our study session so that we do have a process for these things that we can perform consistently and fairly. So I suppose this time it should be a 1-7.
In Friday notes?
No.
Okay.
No.
Okay. So then we... Oh, I'm sorry. We need to vote on...
I made a motion to approve.
No, because I interrupted the process with my questions. So...
I'll second that.
Okay. We have a motion by Mr. Buckman, a second by Mr. Unger. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Thank you. All right. Would anyone like to propose anything for the advance agenda? Then we will move on to reports by board members. Ms. Frame.
It's late, but I'm just going to say that I really had the opportunity to observe that student senate, and that was an amazing experience, and I most certainly will be back. I really enjoyed seeing all the secondary sites represented and their engagement, and their idea of collecting and utilizing information from their peers. I mean, it's kind of like a life skill. So, and the diversity was that was represented on those sites was very intentional, which was great to see. I got the opportunity to see the Living Museum at Teach. That was wonderful. Loved interacting with those students. And then Unger and I, we got to see the Lemonade Wars at Monarch Grove and selecting a book. And so one school, one book.
I think that's
It was a lot of
that's
drama.
I know.
Yeah, so they weren't asking for hamsters, but they did have a drama in a sketch.
No,
I know. So anyway, thank you. It's great.
Mr. Unger.
So I just, in addition to going to the Teach Museum as well, I wanted to thank Assemblyman Jordan Cunningham for his special education advisory group that I've been invited to be a member of that gets together special education directors and SELPA members throughout the county. And just the fact that he is interested in special education, that he's willing to listen to our concerns and hopefully move some things forward in Sacramento, I think is really appreciated by all of us. I did want to let you know that as many of you know, I'm going to South Carolina tomorrow. One of the things we're doing at this meeting I'm going to is we're going to be visiting some schools in Columbia, South Carolina, and we were invited to bring books related to your area. So I just want to thank Michelle Hopper, our district librarian, for some suggestions on books that she gave me, and I'll be presenting those to school in Columbia. And then I will not be attending the next meeting. I will be in Europe. Okay. So. Want to let everybody know that.
Well, happy travels.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Congratulations to our classified and certificated employees of the year, Nancy Bray from Morro Bay High School and Kim Kelly from Bishop's Peak. Well deserved. Great to be recognized by your peers. Thanks, everyone, for the work. See you in 2 weeks. See you on the 10th at a study session. Thank you.